in a building of gold with riches untold.
Grassroots Groceries and Food for the Revolution. Welcome to a special half-hour documentary about the origins and final days of Madison's oldest food co-op, Mifflin Street Community Cooperative. Tonight we hear from community voices about the food and the politics of the co-op and what issues we face now that Mifflin has closed. And the soft
middle class crowd. It's all about grassroots groceries, because if we're going to survive in this world, we have to minimize the miles traveled by our food, we have to minimize the impacts on the land from growing our food, and we have to know one another, and food is what sustains us.
As the windows were smashed by the ringing of revolution.
The Mifflin Street Community Cooperative opened in January 1969 in the heart of Madison's radical student neighborhood. It was a tumultuous and spontaneous time, with police, National Guard, and demonstrators battling in the city streets as the Vietnam War escalated. Mifflin Co-op was at the center of these events as one of the few organizing spaces in a neighborhood struggling for community control. A detailed history of the neighborhood called Miffland and its early days is online at waxingamerica.com in May 2006. Mifflin Community Co-op grew to be a beloved community institution. Mifflin was pivotal in the formation of a cooperative movement both in Madison and around the country. The co-op members own the building, which is graced with a 20-year-old mural created by dozens of people in brilliant collaboration. Mifflin will have a lasting legacy as one of the first food co-ops in the country and one that remained true to its ideals throughout its lifespan. This story is both journalistic and personal for me. My parents were members of Mifflin, as I am now. I shopped there with my child and sold produce there grown in my backyard. Sadly, on December 8, 2006, Mifflin closed its doors after 39 years. We speak with past and present members, staffers, and board members about Mifflin's origins, its politics, and its closure. Former staff collective member June Holte explains.
Mifflin Co-op is a hub of the community, a place where people could come together and be engaged in discussions about food politics. Mifflin is sacred, and I just think of the thousands of people over the years who learned about whole foods for the first time and who saw whole grains for the first time and were able to learn about where their food comes from and how they fit into the web of life. Mifflin Co-op is like one of the mothers, like one of the flagships of food for people, not for profit.
One of the founding members of Mifflin Co-op, Bill Winfield, explains how it all began.
The concept of it really just came out of let's try it, very much like a lot of things in the 60s. The formats that weren't here before, and the influence really was around as much starting a community center as a co-op, as a food store. So it was always linked together as the concept of having a cooperative store along with a radical, essentially, political center was critical. But part of the idea of a co-op is a neighborhood store that we run ourselves. It was important to have your own center. So I think it's always been that way. It was November of 1968. Two or three of us got together and decided that we'd try starting a cooperative neighborhood store. We met in an apartment down the block here and decided that it was my job really to sort of figure out how to do this. And eventually we ended up incorporating it under the, I think it's Chapter 136 Corporation we discovered. Of course, we knew nothing about what we were doing. It was 1968. Eventually, we put together a legal document, incorporated it, and then started raising money by sitting at a table in the union and raising about, I think we were $5 memberships, and ended up getting about $1,500 by the first week of December, right about now. And then we essentially, on January 13th, 1969, opened the store and started selling things, and then it just kept rolling after that.
Norm Stockwell, staff collective member during the 1980s and 90s, explains the mission of Mifflin.
What they wanted to do was to create a locally controlled grocery store at a time when things were beginning to move more and more towards chains and conglomerates. And, you know, we're talking close to 40 years ago right now. And in a sense, the folks that started Mifflin Co-op were very prescient. They were really seeing what has in fact happened to food in this country, you know, in the last couple of decades. But they decided, let's create a locally controlled grocery store. There's a place that came available. They got a bunch of food. They put it on the shelves and they said, hey, folks, come on in and buy this stuff. Mifflin Co-op went through a lot of ups and downs financially over the years, but it always remained true to its mission. And its mission was about local control. It was about alternative economics. That is, not the IBM and AT&T model of bigger is better and, you know, screw the workers and make lots of money, but rather putting people before profits, educating people along with the food they buy. That is talking about food politics and buying locally, not buying from these big multinational mega chains, even though the price might be cheaper, and having a store that serves its local community and is tied to its local community. So that's what Mifflin was all about, and that's, you know, why Mifflin survived and thrived as a model.
Mifflin was indeed a model and influenced decades of cooperative ventures in the region. Local co-ops like Lakeside Press, Nature's Bakery, and the now-defunct Yellow Jersey Bike Co-op were all formed in the wake of Mifflin's success in the 1970s and beyond. Now the Madison area is home to over 55 cooperatives, including food co-ops, housing co-ops, a biofuels co-op, and many more. The University of Wisconsin's Center for Cooperatives estimates that we boast more co-ops than any other city in the country. Bill Winfield explains why he and others looked to the cooperative as a model in the early days.
Before I started it, I went and talked to somebody who ran a Midland co-op, you know, a traditional farm co-op. And I think the history of Wisconsin has been it's a format of a community taking charge over its own resources. And the farm, it goes way back to the 30s. That was key to essentially why we did a co-op. We could do it easily. And also we could do it ourselves. And it was supported. But the dominant models of feed co-op, you know, rural feed co-ops or Midland co-op, and they were quite large. And they emphasized a lot when I talked to them, the management issues. And, you know, it sounded like you were in a business class talking to them. So very quickly, it didn't sound very interesting. And I think the format here was experimental and I hope, inspirational.
Norm Stockwell.
The staff of Mifflin was a collective staff. We kept that collective staff even when others around the city were saying, oh, you have to go to a hierarchical management in order to get things accomplished. We said, no. We said, through the collective process, you get better decisions. It may take a little longer, but it's worth it. Well, at Mifflin, everybody's ideas and everybody's values were important. And the process, the collective process of, you know, meeting for 3 hours a week and debating, you know, everything from the price of peanut butter to whether or not to give money to El Salvador, it was that process that created the what I call common language that allowed that collective staff to function as a whole that was greater than the sum of the parts. And, you know, one thing that's really interesting about the collective process and the consensus decision-making process that was used at a place like Mifflin is, unlike the corporate world model of two competing ideas where, you know, one wins over the other, oftentimes in the collective process, the discussion results in a synthesis of several ideas or in a totally new idea that nobody in the room had thought of before they walked in the door. I think the value of that process is something that that many, many other organizations, you know, have observed, have learned from over the years, and hopefully will continue to.
June Holte.
That doesn't mean it was always easy. Those of us who have served in the collective know that it's really hard work to build consensus and come to understand people that are different than you, but that's an essential part of the progressive movement and progressive ideals, and it was the stuff that Mifflin Co-op was made of.
Esther Schmidt, current member of the Mifflin Staff Collective.
Well, it's great to work in a situation where you have say over what you do, and you don't have to do things that you don't agree with. If you're in a situation where you're just working under somebody, you have no say, and you're doing something that you're morally opposed to, or if it's not good for your health or whatever, you have very little say in actually changing that other than getting fired or having to quit. So in this situation, that power is given back to the people who work there.
John Peck, executive director of Family Farm Defenders and a union member of the Industrial Workers of the World.
Yeah, and the whole idea that workers actually run and operate the business themselves is really an important principle of a fair trade, localized economy. And we have other worker collectives like that in Madison, such as Nature's Bakery and Lakeside Press and 2 Degrees Coffee Shop. But you know, the fact that you know this community, if we really do value the rights of workers and you know, the democracy and the economy, that we should be voting with our dollars to support businesses that are on structured on that model.
Mifflin has proudly been an educator of both members and the public from its very beginnings. Food was and is a political pursuit for the co-op. Current president of the board of directors, Matt Stoner.
One of the things that is really done is it's catalyzed a lot of action around food politics. Mifflin was one of the first organizations that really addressed radical food politics and made that its priority. And over the years, it's had a lot of impact.
Frank Burnham was one of the first paid employees on the staff collective.
You know, I think initially, I don't think we so much talked about the politics of food. That changed over time. Like I said, like when we decided to get rid of cigarettes and soda, it became more of an issue. And also we started buying foods from local farmers. You know, they didn't have the farmers market on the square at that point. But I started in, right around that same, maybe a few years later. So there were people that were trying to sell produce. And, you know, there was quite a number of people that were actually going back to the land. And those people were, you know, friends of some of the people here. So that there was some connection between the people that were going back to, you know, to starting up and being around farms and then bringing in their food and selling it. And also, I think people really thought, well, you know, this is a good idea. You know, this is really, the store should be about changing habits, not just being a place. This, by the way, this discussion of what the store sells was a continuing discussion that I'm guessing is going on at the store, is going on at Mifflin Street to this day. You know, because there was one people that thought we should be in the leadership of what we sell, and the other one that sells that we should reflect what people want to buy.
Longtime Mifflin member and former Madison mayor, Paul Soglin.
There are certain basics in life to which people should have access, shelter, healthcare, food. There was a real conscious effort to understand how the need for food played a role in people's lives and for many people, in effect, kept them subservient, whether it was in this country or in other countries. I mean, this is long before we heard about fair trade coffee.
Longtime Mifflin member and customer, Beth Holden.
I think it has a moral voice that most other stores that are doing better can't have. And I'm, for that reason alone, I wish it would survive, in addition to the food politics. I never really thought about the importance of buying locally until I'd seen people talk about it. And I doubt very much that I would have thought about it had it not been presented to me in this sort of a setting.
Staff collective member Esther Schmidt.
A lot of it is about knowing what is in your food, so being able to make the decision if you want to eat something or not, but also giving some power to the people who actually produce the food, knowing that the person you're buying your food from got a fair wage in the process and has been treated, you know, respectfully and properly in the process. Labor rights and health rights are two fundamental parts of food politics.
Mifflin board member Jennifer Fireherm.
There's all kinds of relationships between food and politics. There's a lot of political decisions. Our ridiculously cheap gas prices, our crazy energy policies are what makes it, our crazy trade policies are what makes black beans from China somehow better on the market than black beans from a small producer like yourself. And until we fix, if we could fix those political choices, it would be a lot easier and a lot more apparent to folks that local organic is the best choice. It is the cheapest choice. It is the least expensive choice when we really figure in all the costs to our society.
John Peck of the Family Farm Defenders.
Yeah, one of the sad things about losing, you know, local co-ops like Mifflin is that the opportunities that farmers have to sell their produce locally is going to dwindle, and you know, a lot of the big natural food stores like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods don't prioritize buying from local farmers, and so it's just going to provide less, you know, less variety for consumers and less options for farmers, and it's going to end up leading more to the globalization of the food system. food security is not the same as food sovereignty. So food security means you can have lots of cheap, you know, food available, but maybe really low quality, like you're saying, or come from far away. And, you know, the idea of food sovereignty means that you'd have local control of your food system. And part of that would be actually knowing, you know, having relationships with the farmers and knowing where your food comes from. And that's from your own bioregion and not coming from Chile or Australia or Madagascar or wherever, you know. And that would also reflect the fact that farmers there also have the right to be able to sell their products in their own countries and not have to worry about U.S. farmers, for instance, dumping on them through agribusiness corporations. So the idea of local control over food is something I don't think consumers really reflect when they're purchasing, say, at a Walmart.
You are listening to a half-hour special here on WORT about the food, the politics, and the people of the recently closed Mifflin Community Co-op. Stay tuned for more voices from the community about big box stores, debt, co-ops, and what we can do about it. Mifflin is a small store with less than 800 square feet of floor space and a steadfast commitment to purchasing and providing local foods. Board member Jennifer Fireherm.
Folks value the farmers market because they're buying directly from the people that grew the food. And Mifflin was the next step, you know, still remaining local. Our collective members are the ones that know the people that grow the food, and we buy from smaller suppliers than any other shop in town. And it really is not very far removed from the direct kind of relationship that you have when you go and buy at a farmer's market.
Matt Stoner, president of the Mifflin Board of Directors.
I think one of the major things that really distinguishes us from larger stores is our ability to deal with suppliers who are equally small. They're even at co-ops that are larger or natural food stores that are larger, and even not even that much larger, but they have ways of interacting with their suppliers that prevent them from dealing with really small people. So we've got people who grow food in their backyards who supplies. We've had our mail woman deliver produce to us before on her mail route. You know, just all sorts of small little stories like that of people who are also operating very small-scale operations who grow and produce amazing and wonderful food. But because they're so small, they don't really fit into a larger size store because for them to take on their product doesn't make any sense because it's just, it would last for like 10 minutes. It allows us to really connect with people on an individual, personal level. That doesn't show up on a balance sheet. It doesn't show up on a income statement, which is part of the reason that Mifflin is struggling.
Jim Huberty is the general manager at neighboring Regent Street Cooperative, one of the last two small co-ops in Madison.
I think some of that is how we value the importance of the store, for example, Mifflin or Regent Market, as being more than just a grocery store. It's a neighborhood connection also for people. So it's a place they can shop, where they run into their friends, they are able to meet new friends. It's a different experience than just going to a larger grocery store, checking out, getting out to the car, driving on to your next destination. So there's a linkage, a connection between the actual store and the community, which I think is important because it allows people, to, as they're growing up, to have this connection within the community so that it's more than just a grocery store. It's kind of a community center. The romance, actually, of small neighborhood grocery stores is something that continues to be affected by and pretty much squeezed out of somewhat of the Walmart experience, where Walmarts tend to force out smaller businesses because they offer so much and the smaller businesses really can't compete with that. So then again, the smaller grocery stores, Mifflin, Regent, and so on, are affected by this, and our margin of error is rather small. I like to say we are definitely not bulletproof.
Board President Matt Stoner.
I think it all really comes down to economics. We have a capitalist system that is set up to reward economies of scale. The bigger you get, the more incentives you get. The price that you get from that we get from our major grocery supplier is directly tied to the size of our store. So the bigger store you are, the cheaper your products are, which gives you more business, which allows you to grow, which cheapens your products, which allows you to grow. And it's just this, like, it's this cycle that Mifflin isn't part of. There are a lot of economic forces that are moving against small businesses, community institutions, and we have a lot more hurdles to jump over. I feel like it's possible, but it needs a lot of work and it needs a lot of community support and commitment.
Jim Huberty on the future of Regent Market.
That is up to the people that are members of the store, even non-members of the store, the shoppers, the people that patronize the store. It is clearly, in my opinion, it's clearly their choice. Food shopping, as with anything, is all about choice. If people choose to shop other places extensively to the exclusion of smaller stores, then of course we cannot, or we will have a huge challenge to try to survive that. It does come down to their choice, because if they choose to shop here in a way that sustains the store, then of course we can succeed. We'll still have pressures, but it's the neighborhoods. It's ultimately their choice as to whether we are here or not. And that says too that we must do our job and operate as efficiently as we can so that we can present them with that continuing choice.
Mifflin was very successful throughout the 1980s and into the 90s, building capital with strong sales and a popular neighborhood block party. It was able to offer loans and grants to many organizations and played a role in the formation of North Farm Co-op food distributors, as well as the now giant Organic Valley brand. But it has been almost 10 years since the store turned a profit, and it has now closed. While it isn't easy to pinpoint a cause for its closure, many agree that declining sales and community involvement, coupled with changing demographics, were too much to overcome. Longtime member Ingrid Roth elaborates.
Well, there are lots of other options now that weren't available when Mifflin first started. There's Willie Street Co-op, even places like Woodman's now carry at least organic food. I'm not sure how locally it is, but Whole Foods is now carrying more locally grown organic food. So there, people who want to support that kind of thing have a number of options. They're not restricted to Mifflin. And I think maybe people, me included, prefer to shop where they have more options in a store that has more floor space.
Former staff member Norm Stockwell on some of the challenges Mifflin faces.
Definitely people's ways of shopping have changed, and the fact that you couldn't find parking around Mifflin is more of an issue now than it was 20 or 30 years ago. The fact that Mifflin didn't have a full array of all the different choices that a larger store has is certainly more of a factor than it was 20 or 30 years ago for people. Also, the idea is about volunteering. People's attitudes towards volunteering and towards compensation in the workplace have changed a lot over the last 20 or 30 years. And whereas, you know, in 1982, when Mifflin was about to go under, the staff worked for several weeks unpaid. When I was hired at Mifflin, the starting wage was $3 or $3.50 an hour, if we can afford it that week. Nowadays, it's more difficult for people to live in that way, frankly, because it's everybody is closer to the edge financially than 20 or 30 years ago. The society has changed in that way. People talk about the change that's going on in the downtown area now. In fact, there's more single-family owner-occupied homes downtown than ever there was 20 years ago. So in some ways, it was a time when Mifflin could have been developing a larger membership, a larger clientele, and people who were more likely to buy lots of stuff because they were in walking distance, they're homeowners. The changes that are happening in the neighborhood now probably could have benefited Mifflin a great deal had the co-op not already been saddled with the financial burden and really been in a position of not being able to ever kind of dig out of that hole. I think some of the new stores, the new commercial natural food stores that have opened in town were going to be a great threat to Mifflin as well, because the issues of parking and the issues of available variety, you know, the decision that the board and the staff and the membership made is the only decision they could have made.
Staff member and board member Josh Stewart.
The one event that sort of spurred on this decision of the board to present a proposal to dissolve Mifflin as a co-op was a unresolved tax issue from years previous. Well, we got word that we were going to be owing, you know, roughly $14,000 in principal, and that there would be fines and penalties incurred beyond that as well. But what has brought Mifflin to the point of not being able to handle a $14,000 bill from the IRS is a lack of community involvement in Mifflin. people tend to gravitate towards grocery stores that offer greater convenience. So they want things like parking. They want things like a broader selection of, rice cakes. That has caused our sales to diminish, and our membership has declined, and volunteer hours in the store have remained relatively consistent, but the workload on the people, on the paid staff, is so significant that without more volunteer assistance, not much can be done in the way of developing, the infrastructure for a successful business. Administrative things are not done because, the shelves need to be stocked.
Former staff and board member and current member Seth Novak.
The thing that I think was somewhat of the demise of Mifflin, financially speaking, was more really the responsibility of the board of directors in their oversight of the internal controls of the finances. We felt like we were making corrective actions and demanding better financial reports and hiring new financial coordinators and getting hiring consultants and assistants and CPAs and like all these kinds of retrospective things to fix things when they were wrong. But it wasn't the fault of the model. And it wasn't the fault of individual collective members that the overall organization was tending in that direction.
Longtime Mifflin member and local historian Stuart Levitan.
It's remarkable that it lasted this long. I mean, there's no market justification for a store of this size in this location to have existed this long. And I think the people who maintained it and kept alive just did a remarkable thing. And I think the board that pulled the plug also did the right thing.
Yeah.
I mean, to have the maturity and sense of responsibility to the broader community to say, no, we can't keep losing money like this because it's outlived its historic point in time, I think was, a sense, that I think that's something to be proud of, that the community actually was able to say, mm-hmm. the market forces of 1970 are not the market forces of 2006.
Board President Matt Stoner.
The sort of work that we are doing and have tried to do over the years is not only still viable, but increasingly important. As our world becomes less and less personal, more and more homogenized and standardized, and it's really, really important and increasingly important to have places like Mifflin that fight that trend.
Board Member Jennifer Fireherm.
Oh, I think it is a viable model. I don't think that the decision that we face tonight speaks about member-owned, collectively-run stores, the local model, keeping the money in the community, all those things are incredibly successful. But we learn as we go. There are lessons that we've learned that we could share with other folks and certainly hope that small, local, community-run organizations continue.
John Peck.
Well, it would really be a loss to the whole community, which is it's unfortunate that we have like a thriving farmers market, but then at the retail level, we're having less and less choices. And my concern now is that we'll be stuck with just giant mega co-ops, which are sort of pseudo co-ops in a lot of ways. And, Regent Street Co-op will go next, and we'll just be stuck with Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, and Willie Street.
The store is now closed, and the shelves are empty again. On the window hangs a banner that reads, "The revolution will not be convenient," an ironic comment on the store's decades-old slogan, "Food for the Revolution." But co-op members and others agree that the spirit of Mifflin indeed lives on, although many of us now wonder where to shop. June Holte offers inspiration.
I think it's time for a resurgence myself. I don't think it's time to let go. I think that it's actually time for people to stand up and say, oh yeah, I forgot about my mother. I mean, I forgot about, the place of education and community and how important that means to me. And I've been absent, and I'm not going to be absent anymore. I'm going to actually step up to the plate and be a part of carrying out that legacy and carrying on that tradition.
And I really do think it's all about grassroots groceries, because if we're going to survive in this world, we have to minimize the miles traveled by our food, we have to minimize the impacts on the land from growing our food, and we have to know one another and live and grow together. And food is what sustains us and what sustains our relationships.
Slave driver, the table is turned. Catch your fire, you're gonna get burned.
You've been listening to Grassroots Groceries, I'm Wajid Jenkins, producer and host. Opening music was Ringing Revolution by Phil Oakes, and we close with Slave Driver by Bob Marley and the Wailers. Many thanks to Jill Hopke, Shelby Floyd, and WYOU Cable Access for audio contributions, and thanks to the volunteers and the staff collective here at WORT. Many, many thanks to the people in the Mifflin community for giving interviews and telling their stories.
Only to be chained in poverty. Good God, I think it's illegal.